fall into big savings, all in the Kroger app.
Get packs of juicy red, green, black, or tri-color variety seedless grapes for $3.99 each. Then get tender boneless chuck roast or steaks for $4.99 a pound, all with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Part B of Chapter 13 of 2 Years in the Forbidden City. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. 2 Years in the Forbidden City by Princess De Ling. Chapter 13, The Empress's Portrait. Part B. After the people had gone, we came from behind the screen, and Her Majesty said, "Let us go and have some more pictures taken while the weather is fine." So she walked the courtyard of the audience hall, where my brother had a camera ready, and had another photograph taken. She said that she would like to have some taken sitting on her throne, exactly as though she were holding an audience. It took us only a few minutes to have everything prepared in the courtyard. The screen was placed behind the throne, and her footstool was also placed ready for her, and she ordered one of the court ladies to go and bring several gowns for her to select from. At the same time, I went and brought some of her favorite jewelry. She ordered the 2 gowns which she had worn at the audiences when she received Admiral Evans and Mrs. Evans to be brought in, and also the same jewels as she had worn on these 2 respective occasions. She had 2 photographs taken in these costumes, 1 in each dress. Next, she wanted one taken in a plain gown, without any embroidery. She then ordered my brother to go and finish the pictures which had already been taken, as she was anxious to see what they were like. She said to my brother, "You wait a minute, I want to go with you and see how you work on them." Of course, I had not considered necessary to explain to Her Majesty the process of developing the pictures, the dark room, etc., so I explained to her as well as I could the whole thing. Her Majesty replied, "It doesn't matter. I want to go and see the room, no matter what kind of room it is." So we all adjourned to the dark room in order to see my brother work on the photographs. We placed a chair so that Her Majesty could sit down. She said to my brother, "You must forget that I am here, and go along with your work just as usual." She watched for a while, and was very pleased when she saw that the plates were developing so quickly. My brother held up the plate to the red light to enable her to see more distinctly. Her Majesty said, "It is not very clear. I can see that it is myself all right, but why is it that my face and hands are dark?" We explained to her that when the picture was printed on paper, these dark spots would show white, and the white parts would be dark. She said, "Well, one is never too old to learn. This is something really new to me. I am not sorry that I suggested having my photograph taken, and only hope that I shall like the portrait painting as well." She said to my brother, "Don't finish these photographs until after I have had my afternoon rest. I want to see you do it." When she got up at about 3:30, it did not take her long to dress herself, as was her usual custom, and she went immediately to where my brother had the papers and everything prepared. He then showed Her Majesty how the printing was done. There was plenty of light, as it was summertime, and as it was only 4 o'clock in the afternoon, the sun was still high. Her Majesty watched for 2 hours while my brother was printing, and was delighted to see each picture come out quite plainly. She held the first one in her hands so long while examining the others, that when she came to look at it again, she found that it had turned quite black. She could not understand this at all, and exclaimed, "Why has this gone black? Is it bad luck?" We explained to her that it must be washed after printing, otherwise a strong light could cause the picture to fade, as this one had done. She said, "How very interesting, and what a lot of work there is." After the printing process had been finished, my brother placed the pictures in a chemical bath, as usual, finally washing them in clean water. This caused Her Majesty even more surprise when she saw how clear the pictures came out, and caused her to exclaim, "How extraordinary! Everything is quite true to life!" When they were finally completed, she took the whole of them to her own room and sat down on her little throne and gazed at them for a long time. She even took her mirrors in order to compare her reflection with the photographs just taken. All this time, my brother was standing in the courtyard awaiting Her Majesty's further commands. Suddenly, she recollected this fact and said, "Why, I had forgotten all about your brother. The poor fellow must be still standing waiting to know what I want next. You go and tell him. No, I had better go and speak to him myself. He has worked so hard all the day that I want to say something to make him feel happy." She ordered my brother to print 10 copies of each of the photographs and to leave all his cameras at the palace in order that he could proceed with the work the next day. The following 10 days it rained continually, which made Her Majesty very impatient, as it was impossible to take any more photographs until the weather improved. Her Majesty wanted to have some taken in the throne room, but this room was too dark, the upper windows being pasted over with thick paper, only the lower windows allowing the light to enter. My brother tried several times, but failed to get a good picture. During this rainy period, the court was moved to the Sea Palace, as the Emperor was to sacrifice at the Temple of Earth. This was a yearly ceremony, and was carried out on similar lines to all other annual ceremonies. On account of the rain, Her Majesty ordered that boats should be brought alongside the west shore of the Summer Palace. On entering the boats, Her Majesty, accompanied by the court, proceeded to the western gate of the city, and on arrival at the last bridge, disembarked. Chairs were awaiting us, and we rode to the gate of the Sea Palace. There, we again entered the boat and proceeded across the lake, a distance of about a mile. While crossing the lake, Her Majesty noticed a lot of lotus plants which were in full bloom. She said, "We are going to stay at least 3 days here. I hope the weather will be fine, as I should like to have some photographs taken in the open boats on the lake. I also have another good idea, and that is, I want to have one taken as Kuan Yin, Goddess of Mercy. The two chief eunuchs will be dressed as attendants. The necessary gowns were made some time ago, and I occasionally put them on. Whenever I have been angry or worried over anything, by dressing up as the Goddess of Mercy, it helps me to calm myself, and so play the part I represent. I can assure you that it does help me a great deal, as it makes me remember that I am looked upon as being all-merciful. By having a photograph taken of myself dressed in this costume, I shall be able to see myself as I ought to be at all times." When we arrived at the private palace, the rain ceased. We walked to her bedroom, although the ground was still in bad condition. One of Her Majesty's peculiarities was a desire to go out in the rain and walk about. She would not even use an umbrella unless it was raining very heavily. The eunuchs always carried out umbrellas, but if Her Majesty did not use her umbrella, of course we could not very well use ours. The same thing applied in everything. If Her Majesty wanted to walk, we had to walk also. And if she decided to ride in her chair, we had to get into our own chairs and ride as well. The only exception to this rule was when Her Majesty, being tired of walking, ordered her stool to rest on. We were not allowed to sit in her presence, but had to stand at all time. Her Majesty liked the Sea Palace better than her palace in the Forbidden City. It was far prettier, and had the effect of making her good-tempered. Her Majesty ordered us to retire early that day, as we were all very tired after the trip, and said that in the event of its being fine the next day, she would have the proposed photographs taken. However, much to Her Majesty's disappointment, it rained incessantly for the next 3 days, so it was decided to stay a few days longer. On the last day of our stay, it cleared up sufficiently to enable the photographs to be taken, after which we all returned to the Summer Palace. The day after our arrival at the Summer Palace, Her Majesty said that we had better prepare everything for the audience to receive the lady artist, Miss Carl. She told the chief eunuch to issue orders to all the other eunuchs not to speak to Miss Carl, but simply be polite as occasion required. We court ladies received similar orders. Also, that we were not to address Her Majesty while Miss Carl was present. The Emperor received several instructions. Her Majesty gave orders to have the gardens of Prince Chong's palace ready. She then said to us, "I trust you three to look after this lady artist. I have already given orders for food to be supplied by the Wai Wu Pu. The only thing that I have been worried about is that I have no foreign food here for Miss Carl." She ordered us to have our stove taken over to Prince Chong's palace in case Miss Carl desired something cooked. She said, "I know it will be very hard for you to take her to the palace each morning and return with her at night, besides having to watch her all day long, but I know you do not mind. You are all doing this for me." After a while, she smiled and said, "How selfish of me. I order you to bring all your things to this place, but what is your father going to do? The best thing will be to ask your father to come and live in the same place. The country air might benefit him." We kowtowed and thanked Her Majesty, as this was a special favor, no official nor anyone else having been allowed to live in Prince Chong's palace previously. We all were very pleased. I could now see my father every day. Hitherto, we had only been able to see him about once a month, and then only by asking special leave. The next day, Her Majesty sent us to Prince Qing's palace to make all necessary arrangements for Miss Carl's stay. This palace of Prince Chong's was a magnificent place. All the smaller dwellings were quite separate from each other, not in one large building, as was the custom. There was a small lake in the grounds, and lovely little paths to walk along, exactly like the Empress Dowager's summer palace, but of course on a much smaller scale. We selected one of these small dwellings, or summer houses, for the use of Miss Carl during her stay, and had it fitted up nicely, to make her as comfortable as possible. We ourselves were to occupy the next house to Miss Carl, in order that we might always be on hand, and at the same time keep a good eye on her. We returned to the summer palace the same evening, and told Her Majesty just how everything had been arranged. She said, "I want you all to be very careful not to let this lady know that you are watching her." She seemed very anxious about this, repeating these instructions for several days prior to Miss Carl's arrival. I felt very much relieved when the day before the audience arrived, and everything was finally fixed to Her Majesty's satisfaction. She ordered us to retire early that evening, as she wanted to rest and look well the next morning. When morning came, we hurried over everything, even the usual morning audience, so that we could be ready when Miss Carl arrived. While I was standing behind the screen, as usual, a eunuch came and told me that Mrs. Conger, the artist, and another lady had arrived, and that they were now in the waiting room. By that time, the audience was about finished. The chief eunuch came in and told Her Majesty that the foreign ladies had arrived and were waiting in another room. Her Majesty said to us, "I think I will go to the courtyard and meet them there." Of course, at all private audiences, Her Majesty received the people in the throne room, but as Miss Carl was more of a guest, she did not think it necessary to go through the usual formal reception. While we were descending the steps, we saw the ladies entering the gate of the courtyard. I pointed out Miss Carl to Her Majesty, and noticed that she eyed Miss Carl very keenly. When we arrived in the courtyard, Mrs. Conger came forward and greeted Her Majesty, and then presented Miss Carl. Her Majesty's first impression of Miss Carl was a good one, as Miss Carl was smiling very pleasantly, and Her Majesty, who always liked to see a pleasant smile, exclaimed to me in an undertone, "She seems to be a very pleasant person." To which I replied that I was very glad she thought so, as I was very anxious about the impression Miss Carl would make on Her Majesty. Her Majesty watched Miss Carl and myself as we greeted each other, and I could see that she was satisfied. She told me afterwards that she had noticed Miss Carl appeared very glad to see me again, and said, "We will handle her pretty easily, I think." Her Majesty then went to her own private palace, and we all followed. On our arrival, Miss Carl told me that she had brought her own canvas. This was a piece about 6 feet by 4 feet. I had told Miss Carl a little previously that Her Majesty refused to sit for a very small portrait, and that she would like a life-size one. When Her Majesty saw the canvas, she appeared to be very much disappointed, as in her opinion, even that was not large enough. We placed the tables ready for Miss Carl, and Her Majesty asked her to choose the position in which she wished to paint. I knew that Miss Carl would have great difficulty in choosing a good position, on account of the windows being built so low, there being very little light except low down near the ground. However, Miss Carl finally placed the canvas near the door of the room. Her Majesty told Mrs. Conger and the rest to sit down for a while, as she wanted to change into another gown. I followed her into her bedroom. The first question Her Majesty asked was how old I thought Miss Carl was, as she herself could not guess her age, her hair being extremely light, in fact, almost white. I could hardly refrain from laughing outright on hearing this, and told Her Majesty that Miss Carl's hair was naturally of a light color. Her Majesty said that she had often seen ladies with golden hair, but never one with white hair, excepting old ladies. She said, "I think that she is very nice, however, and hope she will paint a good portrait." Turning to one of the court ladies, she ordered her to fetch a yellow gown, as although, as she put it, she did not like yellow, she thought it would be the best color for a portrait. She selected one from a number which the court lady brought, embroidered all over with purple wisteria. Her shoes and handkerchiefs matched. She also wore a blue silk scarf, embroidered with the character Shou, long life. Each character had a pearl in the center. She wore a pair of jade bracelets, and also jade nail protectors. In addition, she wore jade butterflies and a tassel on one side of her headdress, and, as usual, fresh flowers on the other side. Her Majesty certainly did look beautiful on that occasion. By the time she came out from her room, Miss Carl had everything prepared. When she saw how Her Majesty was dressed, she exclaimed, "How beautiful Her Majesty looks in this dress!" Which remark I interpreted to Her Majesty, and it pleased her very much. She seated herself in her throne, ready to pose for the picture. She just sat down in an ordinary easy position, placing one hand on a cushion. Miss Carl exclaimed, "This is an excellent position, as it is so natural. Please do not move." I told Her Majesty what Miss Carl said, and she asked me whether she looked all right, or not. If not, she would change her position. I assured her that she looked very grand in that position. However, she asked the opinion of the young empress and some of the court ladies, who all agreed that she could not look better. I could see that they never looked at Her Majesty at all. They were too much interested in what Miss Carl was doing. When Miss Carl commenced to make the rough sketch of Her Majesty, everyone watched with open mouth, as they had never seen anything done so easily and so naturally. The young empress whispered to me, "Although I don't know anything about portrait painting, still I can say that she is a good artist. She has never seen any of our clothes and headdresses, and she has copied them exactly. Just imagine one of our Chinese artists trying to paint a foreign lady. What a mess he would make of it." After the sketch was finished, Her Majesty was delighted and thought it was wonderful for Miss Carl to have made it so quickly and so accurately. I explained that this was a rough sketch, and that when Miss Kral commenced painting, she would soon see the difference. Her Majesty told me to ask Miss Kral whether she was tired and would like to rest. Also, to tell her that she was very busy all the day, and would only be able to give her a few minutes sitting each day. We then took Miss Kral to luncheon, together with Mrs. Conger, and after luncheon we accompanied Her Majesty to the theatre. After Mrs. Conger had departed, I took Miss Kral to my room to rest. As soon as we arrived there, Her Majesty sent a eunuch to call me to her bedroom. Her Majesty said, "I don't want this lady to paint during my afternoon rest. She can rest at the same time. As soon as I am up, you can bring her here to paint. I'm glad that it looks like turning out better than I had anticipated." I therefore told Miss Kral Her Majesty's wishes in this respect, and that she could paint for a little while, if she chose to, after Her Majesty had had her rest. Miss Kral was so interested in Her Majesty, she told me she didn't want to rest at all, but that she would like to go on with the painting right away. Of course, I did not like to tell her anything the first day, as it might upset her, and did not say that this was a command from Her Majesty. After a lot of maneuvering, I got her to give up the idea of continuing straight off, without offending her. I took her out on the veranda, as the eunuch was preparing the table for Her Majesty's dinner, in the room we were then occupying. The young empress kept Miss Kral busy talking, I acting as interpreter. Soon, one of the eunuchs came and informed us that Her Majesty had finished dinner, and would we please come and take ours. On entering the room, I was very much surprised to see that chairs had been placed there, as this had never been done previously. Everybody, with the exception of Her Majesty, taking their meals standing. The young empress was also very much surprised, and asked me whether I knew anything about it. I said that perhaps it was on account of Miss Kral being there. The young empress told me to go over and ask Her Majesty, as she was afraid to sit down without receiving orders to do so. Her Majesty whispered to me, "I don't want Miss Kral to think we are barbarians, and treat the young empress and the court ladies in that manner. Of course, she does not understand our court etiquette, and might form a wrong impression. So you can all sit down without coming over to thank me, but be natural, as though you were accustomed to sitting down to dinner every day." After Her Majesty had washed her hands, she came over to our table. Of course, we all stood up. Her Majesty told me to ask Miss Kral whether she liked the food, and was pleased when Miss Kral answered that she liked the food better than her own kind. That relieved Her Majesty. After dinner was over, I told Miss Kral to say good-bye to Her Majesty. We curtsied to her, also to the young empress, and said good-night to the court ladies. We then took Miss Kral to the palace of Prince Tong. It took us about 10 minutes' ride in the carts. We showed Miss Kral her bedroom, and were pleased to leave her and get to our own rooms, for a good night's rest. The next morning, we took Miss Kral to the palace, and arrived there during the morning audience. Of course, Miss Kral, being a foreigner, could not enter the throne room, so we sat down on the back veranda of the audience hall and waited until it was over. This, of course, prevented my being in attendance each morning, as usual, and was a great disappointment to me, as I was unable to keep in touch with what was taking place. Moreover, during the time I had been at court, my one object had been to endeavor to interest Her Majesty in Western customs and civilization. I believed that, to a great extent, Her Majesty was becoming interested in these things, and would refer the subjects of our conversation to her ministers, for their opinions. For instance, I had shown her photographs taken of a naval review at which I was present in France. Her Majesty seemed to be impressed, and said that she would certainly like to be able to make a similar display in China. This matter she consulted with her ministers, but they gave the usual evasive answer, viz., "There is plenty of time for that." From this you will see that Her Majesty was not able to introduce reforms entirely alone, even though she might desire to do so, but had to consult the ministers, who would always agree with Her Majesty, but would suggest that the matter be put off for a time. My experience while at the palace was that everybody seemed to be afraid to suggest anything new, for fear they might get themselves into trouble. When Her Majesty came out from the audience hall, Miss Carl went up to her and kissed Her Majesty's hand, which caused her great surprise, although she did not show it at the time. Afterwards, however, when we were alone, she asked me why Miss Carl had done this, as it was not a Chinese custom. She naturally thought that it must be a foreign custom, and therefore said nothing about it. Her Majesty then proceeded on foot to her own palace to change her dress for the portrait. It was a beautiful morning, and when she had posed for about 10 minutes, she told me that she felt too tired to proceed, and asked if it would be all right to ask Miss Carl to postpone it. I explained that as Miss Carl was going to be at the palace for some time, the postponement of one day's sitting would not make much difference at that time, although I knew that Miss Carl would naturally be disappointed. Still, I had to humor Her Majesty as much as possible, otherwise she might have thrown up the whole thing. Miss Carl said that if Her Majesty wished to go rest, she would be working painting the screen and throne, and Her Majesty could pose again later on if she felt like it. This pleased Her Majesty, and she said that she would try to sit again after taking her afternoon's rest. Her Majesty ordered me to give Miss Carl her lunch in my own room at 12 o'clock each day, my mother, my sister, and myself keeping her company. Dinner at the palace was usually taken about 6 o'clock, and it was arranged that Miss Carl should take dinner with the young empress and the court ladies at that hour, after Her Majesty had finished dining. Her Majesty also ordered that champagne or any other wine which Miss Carl preferred should be served, as she said she knew it was the custom for all foreign ladies to take wine with their meals. Where she got hold of this idea, nobody knew. I was sure that Her Majesty had been misinformed by somebody, but it would have been bad policy to have tried to tell her different at the moment. She disliked very much to be told that she was wrong in any of these things, and it could only be done by waiting and casually introducing the subject at some other time. After Miss Carl had gone to rest during the afternoon, Her Majesty sent for me and asked the usual question, viz., what had Miss Carl been saying, etc., etc. She seemed particularly anxious to know what Miss Carl thought of her, and when I told her that Miss Carl had said that she was very beautiful and quite young-looking, she said, "Oh, well, of course, Miss Carl would say that to you." However, on my assuring her that Miss Carl had given this opinion without being asked for, she showed very plainly that she was not at all displeased with the compliment. Suddenly, Her Majesty said, "I have been thinking that if Miss Carl can paint the screen and the throne, surely she ought to be able to paint my clothes and jewels without it being necessary for me to pose all the time." I told her that would be quite impossible, as nobody could hold the things for Miss Carl to get the proper effect. To my surprise, she answered, "Well, that is easily gotten over. You wear them in my place." I hardly knew what to say, but thought I would get out of the difficulty by telling her that perhaps Miss Carl would not like such an arrangement. Her Majesty, however, could see no possible objection on Miss Carl's part, as she herself could pose when the time came for painting her face. So I put the matter as nicely as possible to Miss Carl, and it was finally arranged that I should dress in Her Majesty's robes and jewels whenever Her Majesty felt too tired to do the posing herself. In this manner, the portrait of the Empress Dowager was painted, and with the exception of just a few hours, to enable Miss Carl to get Her Majesty's facial expression, I had to sit for 2 hours each morning, and for another 2 hours each afternoon, until the portrait was finished. End of Part B of Chapter 13. Read by J.C. Guan, Montreal, January 2009. Chapter 14 of 2 Years in the Forbidden City. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by J.C. Guan. 2 Years in the Forbidden City by Princess De Ling. Chapter 14. The Emperor's Birthday. My father's 4 months' leave having expired, he was received in audience by their majesties on the first day of the sixth moon. He was much improved in health, but his rheumatism was still very troublesome. This was particularly noticeable when climbing the steps to the audience hall, and Her Majesty ordered 2 of the eunuchs to assist him. First, he thanked Her Majesty for her kindness towards my sister and myself, and, as was the custom, took off his hat and knelt down, bowing his head until it struck the ground. This ceremony was always gone through by any official who had received special favors from their majesties. He then replaced his hat on his head and remained kneeling before the throne. Her Majesty then questioned him about his life in Paris, from time to time complimenting him on his work. Seeing that remaining in this kneeling position appeared to be making him tired, Her Majesty ordered one of the eunuchs to bring a cushion for him to use, which was another great honor, as this cushion was only used by the President of the Grand Council. Her Majesty told him that as he was now getting to be a very old man, she did not intend sending him away from China again, as she wanted to keep my sister and myself at the court, which she could not do if she sent him to some foreign country, as he would want to take his daughters with him. She said she was pleased that although we had been away from China for such a long time, we were well acquainted with the Manchu customs. My father replied that it had been his care that we should be brought up according to the customs of our own country. Her Majesty then asked the Emperor if he had anything to say, and he replied by asking my father if he spoke French, and thought it very strange on learning that he did not. My father explained that he had never had the time to study it, besides which he considered himself too old to learn a foreign language. The Emperor next asked what was the feeling in France towards China. My father replied that they were very friendly at that time, but that immediately after the Boxer trouble, the post of minister had been a very embarrassing one. Her Majesty said that it had been an unfortunate affair, but she was glad that everything was now settled satisfactorily. She told my father that he was to get well again as quickly as possible, and the audience came to an end. Afterwards, Her Majesty said that my father was looking very old since his return from France, and that he would have to be careful and take things easy until he got stronger again. She was pleased that he had shown appreciation of her interest in my sister and myself. Preparations were now commenced for celebrating the birthday of His Majesty, the Emperor Guangxu, which was to take place on the 28th of that month. The actual date of the Emperor's birthday was the 26th of the sixth moon, but this day, being the anniversary of the death of a previous Emperor of China, we were unable to hold any festivities, and so it was always celebrated on the 28th day instead. The official celebration lasted for 7 days, 3 days before and 4 days after the actual date. During that time, the whole of the court dressed in official robes, and no business of any kind whatever was attended to. This being the Emperor's 32nd birthday, and as the full celebrations only took place every 10th year, i.e. on his 20th birthday, his 30th birthday, and so on, the festivities were not carried out on a very grand scale. However, it was quite sufficient to interfere with old business, and the usual morning audiences did not take place during these 7 days. The Empress Dowager herself was the only person who did not dress especially during these celebrations, and who did not take any active part in the festivities. Another reason why the celebrations were not carried out on a very large scale was the fact that the Empress Dowager, being alive, she took precedence, according to the Manchu custom, over the Emperor himself. In fact, she was the actual ruler of the country, the Emperor being second. The Emperor was quite aware of this fact, and when the Empress commanded that preparations be commenced for the celebrations, the Emperor would always suggest that it was not at all necessary to celebrate the occasion, unless it happened to be a 10th year, and would very reluctantly agree to the festivities taking place. Of course, this was more out of politeness on the part of the Emperor, and to conform to the recognized etiquette. But the nation recognized this birthday, and naturally celebrated according to the usual custom. During this period, therefore, the painting of the portrait was postponed. When the morning of the 25th arrived, the Emperor dressed himself in his official robe, yellow gown, embroidered with gold dragons, and coat of a reddish-black color. Of course, being the Emperor, in place of the usual button on the hat, he wore a large pearl. I might mention that the Emperor was the only person who could wear this particular pearl in place of a button. He came as usual to wish Her Majesty Jixiang, and then proceeded to the temple to worship before the ancestral tablets. After this ceremony was over, he returned to the Empress Dowager and kowtowed to her. All the Chinese adopt this rule of kowtowing to their parents on their own birthdays, as a sign of reverence and respect. The Emperor next proceeded to the audience hall, where all the ministers were assembled, and received their salutations and congratulations. This ceremony often caused amusement, for to see several hundred people all bobbing their heads up and down, especially when they did not all manage to do it together, was a very funny sight. Even the Emperor himself had to laugh, it was such an extraordinary spectacle. The musical instruments which were used during the ceremony deserve a little description. The principal instrument is made of hard wood, and has a flat bottom about 3 feet in diameter, with a dome-shaped top raised about 3 feet from the ground. The inside is quite hollow. A long pole, made of the same material, is used as a drumstick, and an official, specially appointed, beats with all his might on the drum. The noise can be better imagined than described. This is used as a signal to announce when the Emperor takes his seat upon the throne. In addition to the above, a full-sized model of a tiger, also made of similar hard wood, and having 24 scales on its back, is brought into the courtyard. In this case, they did not beat the instrument, but scraped along its back over the scales, which emitted a noise similar to the letting off simultaneously of innumerable crackers. The noise was kept up during the whole of the ceremony, and what with the drum and this tiger instrument, it was sufficient to deafen one. During the ceremony, an official crier used to call out the different orders, such as when to kneel, bow, stand up, kowtow, etc., etc., but with the noise it was quite impossible to hear a single word of what he uttered. Another instrument was composed of a frame made of wood, about 8 feet high by 3 feet broad. Across this frame were three wooden bars, from which was suspended 12 bells, made out of pure gold. When these were struck with a wooden stick, the sound was not at all unlike the dulcimer, only, of course, very much louder. This was placed on the right side of the audience hall. On the left side, a similar instrument was placed, with the exception that the bells were carved out of white jade. The music, which could be brought out of the instrument, was very sweet. When this ceremony of receiving the ministers was concluded, the Emperor proceeded to his private palace, where the young Empress, his wife, the secondary wife, and all the court ladies were gathered, and, after kowtowing, all of the court ladies present, led by the young Empress, knelt before him and presented him with a zhuyi. This is a kind of scepter. Some are made out of pure jade, while others are made out of wood inlaid with jade. This zhuyi is a symbol of good luck and was supposed to bring happiness and prosperity to the person to whom it was presented. The ceremony was gone through to the accompaniment of music played on string instrument, which was very sweet. Next, the eunuchs were received by the emperor, and they similarly congratulated him, but without the accompaniment of music. After the eunuchs came the servants' girls, and the whole of the ceremony was over. The emperor next proceeded to Her Majesty's palace, where he knelt before Her Majesty and thanked her for the celebration which had been given in his honor, after which Her Majesty, accompanied by the whole court, went to the theatre to see the play. On arrival at the theatre, we were all presented by Her Majesty with sweetmeats, this being the custom on these occasions, and after a little while Her Majesty retired for her afternoon rest. Thus the celebration ended. 2 days after the celebration the seventh moon commenced. The seventh day of the seventh moon was the occasion of another important anniversary. The two stars, Niu Lang, Capricorn, and Zhenyu, Lyra, are supposed to be the patrons of agriculture and weaving, and, according to a tradition, were at one time man and wife. As the result of a quarrel, however, they were doomed to live apart, being separated from each other by the Milky Way. But on the seventh day of the seventh moon of each year, they are allowed to see each other, and the magpies are supposed to build a bridge to enable them to meet. The ceremony is rather peculiar. Several basins full of water were placed so that the sun's rays will fall upon them. Her Majesty then took several tiny needles and dropped one into each basin. These floated on the water, casting a shadow across the bottom of the basins. These shadows took different forms, according to the position of the needle, and if the shadow took certain prescribed forms, the person throwing in the needle was supposed to be very lucky and clever, while if they represented certain other forms, they were despised by the gods as being ignorant. In addition, Her Majesty burnt incense and offered up prayers to the two gods referred to. This was always a sad moon for Her Majesty, it being the anniversary of the death of her husband, the Emperor Xianfeng, who died on the 17th of that month. The 15th of the seventh moon each year is the day of the festival for the dead, and early in the morning the court moved to the Sea Palace in order to sacrifice. The Chinese hold that when a person dies, his soul still remains on the earth, and on these anniversaries they burn imitation money, the belief being that the soul of the departed one will benefit to the extent of the amount of money so represented. On the anniversary above referred to, Her Majesty sent for hundreds of Buddhist priests to pray for those unfortunate people who had died without leaving anyone who could sacrifice for them. On the evening of this day, Her Majesty and all her court ladies set out in open boats on the lake, where imitation lotus flowers were arranged as lanterns, with a candle placed in the center, which formed a sort of floating light, the idea being to give light to the spirits of those who had departed during the year, as to enable them to come and receive the blessings which had been prepared for them. Her Majesty ordered us to light the candles and place the flowers on the water ourselves, as she said it would be appreciated by the spirits of the dead. Some of the eunuchs had told Her Majesty that they had actually seen some of these spirits, which assertion was thoroughly believed. Although she had never seen them herself, she accounted for this by the fact that she was of too high rank, and the spirits were afraid of her. But she ordered all the rest of us to keep a sharp lookout and tell her if we saw anything. Of course, we didn't see anything, but many of the court ladies were so frightened that they closed their eyes for fear they might see something supernatural. Her Majesty was devoted to the late Emperor Xianfeng, and she was very sad and morose during this period. We all had to be very careful indeed not to upset her in any way, as she would find fault on the slightest provocation. she hardly had a word to say to any of us, and cried almost incessantly. I could hardly understand the reason for such grief, seeing that the emperor had died so many years previously. None of the court ladies were allowed to dress in light-colored gowns during the whole of the seventh moon. We all dressed either in dark blue or pale blue, while Her Majesty herself dressed in black every day without exception. Even her handkerchiefs were black. The theaters, which were usually opened on the 1st and 15th of each month, were closed during the seventh moon. There was no music, and everything was conducted in the most solemn manner. In fact, the whole court was in deep mourning. On the morning of the 17th day of the seventh moon, Her Majesty visited the late Emperor's tablet, and knelt there crying for quite a while. In order to show respect for the late Emperor, none of us were allowed to eat meat for 3 days. This being my first year at the palace, it appeared to me very strange, after the customary gaiety and noise. Of course, I felt very sorry for Her Majesty, as I could see, as it was a genuine display of grief, and was not in any way put on. As I was her favorite at that time, she kept me close to her side during this sad period. The young empress said to me one day, "Her Majesty is very much attached to you, and I think you had better stay with her for the time being." This I did, and was so miserable myself that when Her Majesty commenced crying, I would cry also. When she saw that I was crying, Her Majesty would immediately stop and ask me not to cry. She would tell me that I was too young to cry, and that in any case I did not know what real sorrow was as yet. During the conversation we had at that time, she would tell me quite a lot about herself. On one occasion, she said, "You know, I have had a very hard life ever since I was a young girl. I was not a bit happy when with my parents, as I was not the favorite. My sisters had everything they wanted, while I was, to a great extent, ignored altogether. When I first came to the court, a lot of the people were jealous of me, because I was considered to be a beautiful woman at that time. I must say myself that I was a clever one, for I fought my own battles, and won them too. When I arrived at the court, the late emperor became very much attached to me, and would hardly glance at any of the other ladies. Fortunately, I was lucky in giving birth to a son, as it made me the emperor's undisputed favorite. But after that, I had very bad luck. During the last year of his reign, the emperor was seized with a sudden illness. In addition to this, the foreign soldiers burnt down the palace at Yuanmingyuan, so we fled to Zhehe. Of course, everybody knows what took place at that time. I was still a young woman, with a dying husband and a young son. The East Empress Dowager's nephew was a bad man, who coveted the throne, which he had no right to in any event, as he was not of royal blood. I would not wish anyone to experience what I myself passed through at that time. When the Emperor was in that dying condition, being practically unconscious of what was taking place around him, I took my son to his bedside, and asked him what was going to be done about his successor to the throne. He made no reply to this, but, as has always been the case in emergencies, I was equal to the occasion, and I said to him, "Here is your son." On hearing which, he immediately opened his eyes, and said, "Of course, he will succeed to the throne." I naturally felt relieved when this was settled once and for all. These words were practically the last he spoke, for he died immediately afterwards. Although it is now so many years ago, I can see him now, in that dying condition, just as though it all happened only yesterday. I thought that I could be happy with my son as the Emperor Tongzhi, but unfortunately he died before he was 20 years of age. Since that time I have been a changed woman, as all happiness was over as far as I was concerned when he died. I had also quite a lot of trouble with the East Empress Dowager, and found it very difficult to keep on good terms with her. However, she died 5 years after the death of my son. In addition to all this, when the Emperor Guangxu was brought to me as a baby 3 years old. He was a very sickly child, and could hardly walk. He was so thin and weak. His parents seemed to be afraid of giving him anything to eat. You know, his father was Prince Zhong, and his mother was my sister. So, of course, he was almost the same as my own son. In fact, I adopted him as such. Even now, after all my trouble on his account, he is not in perfect health. As you know, I have had plenty of other troubles beside these, but it is useless to mention them now. I am disappointed with everything, as nothing has turned out as I had expected. With this remark, Her Majesty commenced crying afresh. Continuing, she said, "People seem to think that just because I am the Empress Dowager, that I am bound to be happy. But what I have just told you is not all. I have gone through much more than that. If ever anything went wrong, I was always the one who was blamed. The censors even dared to impeach me once in a while. However, I am philosopher enough to take things for what they are worth. Otherwise, I would have been in my own grave long, long ago. Just imagine how small-minded these people are. Amongst other things, they objected to my transferring my court to the summer palace during the hot weather, although I could do no harm by being there. Even in the short time you have spent at court, you can see that I am unable to decide anything alone, while whenever they want anything, they consult with each other and then present their petition to me, which, unless it is something of a very serious nature, I never think of refusing. After the time set apart for mourning had expired, we all went back to the summer palace, where Miss Carl recommenced her work on Her Majesty's portrait. Her Majesty apparently soon got tired of this portrait painting, for one day she asked me when I thought it would be finished. She was afraid that it would not be finished by the time the cold weather came on, when we always removed the court to the Forbidden City, and she said it would be a lot of trouble and inconvenience to have to continue the portrait there. I told Her Majesty that it could easily be arranged and that she need not worry herself. After I had been posing in Her Majesty's place for several days, Her Majesty asked me whether Miss Carl had said anything about it. And if she did, I was to inform her that it was a command from Her Majesty, and that I did not make any further suggestion in that respect. So we had no further trouble with Miss Carl after that. I had, however, quite a lot of trouble with the eunuchs, who, in spite of Her Majesty's instructions, were anything but polite to Miss Carl. Of course, Miss Carl herself did not know this. I tried to make them behave better by threatening to tell Her Majesty about them, which had a good effect for a while, but they were soon as bad as ever. At the commencement of the 8th moon, Her Majesty always attended to the transplanting of her chrysanthemums, which was one of her favorite flowers. So each day she would take us with her to the west side of the lake, and, assisted by us, would cut the tops of the young plants and set them in flower pots. I was very much surprised at this, as there were no roots, only the stems of the flowers. But Her Majesty assured me that they would soon grow into very pretty plants. Every day we went over to water these flowers until they began to bud. In case it rained heavily, Her Majesty would order some of the eunuchs to go over and cover up these chrysanthemum plants with mats, so that they would not be broken. It was characteristic of Her Majesty that no matter what other business she had to attend to, her flowers had her first consideration, and she would, if necessary, even go without her usual rest in order to superintend them personally. She also spent quite a time in looking after her orchard, where she had planted apple trees, pear trees, etc. Another thing which I began to notice was that when the spring and summer days had passed, she got quite irritable and sad, while in the winter she was simply unbearable. She loathed cold weather. One night, during the 8th moon, Her Majesty was taken slightly ill, and complained of suffering from severe headaches. This was the only time I ever saw Her Majesty actually sick. She, however, got up as usual in the morning, and held audience, but was unable to take her luncheon, and very soon had to retire to her bed. several doctors were summoned, each of whom took her pulse. This was quite a ceremony in itself. The doctors knelt at the bedside, and Her Majesty stretched forth her arm, resting her hand upon a small pillow, which was provided for that purpose. After this, each doctor wrote out his prescription, all of which were different from each other. We handed them to Her Majesty, who chose the one which she thought was the nicest to take, and two attendants and the doctor himself had to take a dose in her presence before she would touch it. Then she would take it all right. During this time, it rained a great deal and was very hot. The climate at this time of the year is very damp, which causes the flies to make their appearance in millions. If there was one thing more than another that Her Majesty detested, it was these flies. During the actual summer, they were not so troublesome as at this particular time. Of course, every precaution was taken to keep them away, a eunuch being posted at each door, provided with a sort of switch made of horsehair fastened at the end of a bamboo pole. We were never troubled by mosquitoes, however. In fact, I never saw a mosquito curtain in the palace during the whole of my stay there. These flies were an abomination, and in spite of all that could be done, a few would find their way into the rooms. Whenever they alighted on Her Majesty, she would scream, while if by any chance one were to alight on her food, she would order the whole lot to be thrown away. This would spoil her appetite for the whole day, and put her into a terrible temper as well. Whenever she saw one anywhere near her, she would order whoever happened to be present to go and catch it. I myself often received this order, but I detested them almost as much as Her Majesty did. They were so dirty, and stuck to one's hands whenever they touched them. After her illness, Her Majesty was indisposed more or less for quite a long time, and doctors were constantly in attendance. She took so many different kinds of medicine that instead of getting better, she got worse and eventually contracted a fever. Her Majesty was very much afraid of fevers of any kind, and we had to stay with her all night and all day, and had to take our meals whenever we could get away from her bedside for a few minutes. Another peculiarity was Her Majesty's aversion for any kind of perfume near her when she was sick, while when she was feeling well, she was simply smothered in it. The same applied to fresh flowers. In spite of her love for them under ordinary conditions, when she was sick, she could not bear them anywhere near. Her nerves became absolutely unstrung, as she was unable to sleep during the day, and consequently the time passed very slowly to her. In order to make the time pass a little less tediously, she gave instructions for one of the better-educated eunuchs to read to her during the daytime. This reading generally consisted of ancient Chinese history, poetry, and all kinds of Chinese lore, and while the eunuch was reading to her, we had to stand by her bedside, one of us being told off to massage her legs, which seemed to soothe her somewhat. This same program was gone through every day, until she was completely herself again, some 10 days later. One day, Her Majesty asked me, "What kind of medicine does a foreign doctor usually give in case of a fever?" "I have heard that they make you take all kinds of pills. This must be very dangerous, as you never know what they are made of. Here in China, all medicines are made from roots, and I can always find out whether I am receiving the right medicine, as I have a book which explains what each different medicine is for. Another thing I have heard is that foreign doctors generally operate on you with a knife, while we cure the same sickness by means of our medicine." Li Lianying told me that one of our little eunuchs had a boil on his wrist, and someone advised him to go to the hospital. Of course, they didn't know what they would do, and the foreign doctors there opened the boil with a knife, which frightened the child very much. I was very much surprised when I heard he was all right again in a couple of days. Continuing, Her Majesty said, "A year ago, one of the foreign ladies came to the palace, and hearing me cough a lot, gave me some black pills and told me to swallow them. I did not like to offend her, so I took the pills and told her I would take them by and by. However, I was afraid to take them and throw them away. Of course, I answered that I didn't know much about medicines, to which she replied that she had seen me take foreign medicines whenever I was not feeling well. She then said, "Of course, I know there are people in Beijing who do take the medicines given them by foreign doctors, and even some of my own relatives patronize these foreigners also. They try not to let me know, but I do know for all that. In any case, if they choose to kill themselves by taking these pills, it is none of my business. That is the reason why, when they are sick, I never send my own doctors to attend them." When Her Majesty had completely recovered from her illness, she used to go out on the lake a great deal, sometimes in an open boat, and at other times in a steam launch. She always appeared to enjoy this kind of thing. For some reason or other, she always insisted on taking the west side of the lake, which was very shallow, and invariably the launch would get stuck fast in the mud, which seemed to afford Her Majesty great enjoyment. She simply loved to feel the launch strike the bottom. The open boat would then come alongside, and we would have to get out of the launch and enter the boat, and proceed to the top of the nearest hill to watch the efforts of the eunuchs trying to refloat the launch. It was a characteristic of Her Majesty to experience a keen sense of enjoyment at the troubles of other people. The eunuchs knew this quite well, and whenever opportunity offered, they would do something which they thought would amuse Her Majesty. So long as it was nothing of a serious nature, Her Majesty would always overlook it. But in case it proved serious, or was carelessness, she would always order them to be severely punished. Thus, it was very hard to tell just what to do in order to please her. Another of Her Majesty's peculiarities was inquisitiveness. For example, as I have stated before, it was the custom for Her Majesty to have sweetmeats brought to her before every meal, and after she had finished with them, the remainder were distributed among the court ladies. Whenever it happened that we were very busy, we did not bother with the sweetmeats at all, which Her Majesty very soon found out. One day, after she had finished dining, she came and looked through the window to see what we were doing, and saw some of the eunuchs eating the sweetmeats which she had given us. She did not say anything, but simply ordered that the sweetmeats should be brought back again, making us believe that she wanted some more herself. I knew that there was something wrong, as she never ordered them back before. When she saw what was left of them, she asked who had been eating so many, as they were nearly all finished. But she got no reply. We were all too scared. However, after thinking it over, I came to the conclusion that it would be best to tell her the truth, for I was quite certain that she knew anyhow. So I told her that we had all been very busy, and had forgotten all about the sweetmeats, and that the eunuchs had come and taken them themselves, and I added that this was not the first time they had done so. I was rather glad that she had given me this opportunity to report the eunuchs, for Her Majesty replied that if she intended the eunuchs to have sweetmeats, she herself would give them some, but thought it a lack of appreciation on our part not eating them ourselves after she had been so kind as to provide them for us. She turned to me and said, "I am glad that you have told me the truth, as I saw myself what was happening." She gave orders that the offending eunuchs should each have 3 months' wages deducted as a punishment. But of course, I knew very well they didn't mind that, as they were making many times the amount of their salary in other ways. On my return to the sitting-room, one of the court ladies said, "You should not have told Her Majesty about the eunuchs. They are sure to revenge themselves in some way." I asked how they could possibly injure me in any way, as they were only servants. But she told me that they would find some underhand way in which to get even with me, this being their general custom. Of course, I knew the eunuchs were a bad lot, but could not say what cause they had to be against me in any way. I knew they dare not say anything against me to Her Majesty, so I forgot all about the matter. I found out afterwards that one of the tricks they used to play on any of the court ladies who offended them was to try and prejudice Her Majesty against us. For instance, if Her Majesty told one of the eunuchs that a certain thing should be done, instead of telling me what Her Majesty wanted, the eunuch would go off to one of the other ladies and tell her. In this way, Her Majesty would get the impression that I was too lazy to wait upon her myself, and of course, the other lady would get all the credit. Although Her Majesty was very kind to me, also the young Empress, it was very hard to get along with the eunuchs, and it was not good policy to offend them in any way. They regarded themselves as being exclusively the servants of Her Majesty, the Empress Dowager, and refused to take instructions from anybody else. Consequently, they were often very rude to the other ladies of the court, not even excepting the young Empress. Everything proceeded as usual until the 8th moon, when the Emperor was to sacrifice at the Temple of the Sun. On this occasion, the Emperor wore a red robe. About this time, Mrs. Conger asked for a private audience, as she wanted to see Her Majesty, and at the same time see how the portrait was progressing. Her Majesty replied that she would receive her, and gave orders accordingly. At this private audience, Mrs. Conger brought into the court two of her relatives to be presented to Her Majesty, besides Miss Campbell and a missionary lady. As it was a private audience, the guests were conducted to Her Majesty's private palace. They were received in the hall which was being used as studio for this lady artist, although Her Majesty was quite out of patience with the portrait painting, and talked to us a great deal about it, yet when she saw Mrs. Conger and the others, she was extremely polite and told them that the portrait was going to be a masterpiece. She was in an unusually good humor that day, and told me to give orders to the eunuchs to open all the buildings and show them to her guests. Her Majesty led the way from one room to another, and showed them her curios in the different rooms, until she came to rest in one of the bedrooms, when she ordered chairs to be brought in for the guests. There were many chairs in this room, but they were really small thrones of Her Majesty's, although they looked like any ordinary chairs. The custom is that, no matter what kind of a chair it may be, as soon as she uses it, it is at once called her throne, and no one is allowed to sit on it thereafter, unless the order is given by her. During the time the eunuchs were bringing in the chairs kept purposely for foreigners to use, one of the ladies of the party made a mistake and sat upon one of Her Majesty's thrones. I noticed her at once, and before I had a chance to warn her, Her Majesty made a sign of annoyance to me. I went to this lady at once and told her I wanted to show her something, and naturally she was obliged to get up. The trouble was this: although Her Majesty felt that no one had the right to sit upon her throne, she expected me to get this lady off the chair, and at the same time not to tell her the reason why. While I was busy interpreting for her, she said in an undertone, "There she is again, sitting on my bed. We had better leave this room." After this, the ladies were conducted to the refreshment room, and when they had partaken of lunch, bade Her Majesty good-bye, leaving Miss Carl with us. As usual, we reported to her that we had seen the guests safely off. She said to me, "That was a funny lady. First, she sat upon my throne, and then upon my bed. Perhaps she does not know what a throne is when she sees one, and yet foreigners laugh at us. I am sure that our manners are far superior to theirs. Another thing, did you notice that Mrs. Conger landed a parcel to Miss Carl out in the courtyard when she came in?" I replied that I had noticed her passing something like a parcel, but could not tell what the parcel contained. She thereupon told me to go and ask Miss Carl what it was. At that time, I had received so many peculiar orders from Her Majesty that I was beginning to get accustomed to them and used my own discretion in carrying out her instructions. Therefore, I did not ask Miss Carl, but set about finding out for myself. However, when I began to look around for the parcel, it had mysteriously disappeared, and I could not find the thing anywhere. This naturally worried me, knowing as I did that Her Majesty liked her instructions carried out quickly. While I was searching, one of the eunuchs came in and told me that Her Majesty wanted to see me, and of course I had to go to her. Before she could say anything to me, I informed Her Majesty that I had not been able to ask Miss Carl about the parcel as she was asleep, but would do so immediately after she got up. Her Majesty said, "I don't want Miss Carl to think I have told you to ask what the parcel contains. Otherwise, she might think I am suspicious of what is going on. So you must manage to get the information somehow without mentioning the matter. You are clever enough to do that much." Shortly afterwards, while I was walking along with Miss Carl to Her Majesty's palace to proceed with the portrait, I noticed that she was carrying the parcel in question, which was a great relief to me, I can assure you. On arrival at the palace, Miss Carl said to me, "You need not trouble to pose at present, as it is rather dark, and I can be painting the throne. You can look through this magazine, if you like, to pass the time away." So I opened up the parcel, which proved to contain nothing more than an ordinary American monthly magazine. After glancing through the book, I made an excuse to hurry away and inform Her Majesty. However, she had already gone out for her usual trip on the lake, so I took my chair and followed. When I reached the lake, Her Majesty, who had seen me, sent a small boat and I was rowed out to the launch. Before I could get a chance to speak, Her Majesty said with a smile, "I know all about it. It was a book, and Miss Carl handed it to you to read." I was very much disappointed that I had had my journey for nothing. I knew that the eunuchs would report it to Her Majesty at the first opportunity, but I hardly expected they would have done so already. Her Majesty was now quite satisfied, and simply asked whether Miss Carl suspected that she had inquired about the matter. As I was about to return to Miss Carl, Her Majesty called me and said, "There is one thing I want to tell you, and that is whenever any foreign ladies are visiting the palace, always keep close to the Emperor, so that, in the event of their speaking to him, you can interpret." I answered that so far, whenever any foreigners were present, I was present also, and did not think that anybody had held any conversation with the Emperor whatsoever. She explained that her reason for mentioning this was that she wanted me to be just as courteous to the Emperor as I was to herself, and I was to place myself entirely at his disposal whenever visitors were present. Of course, I knew very well that this was not the true reason at all, but that she wanted to take every precaution to preclude the possibility of foreigners influencing the Emperor in matters of reform, etc. End of chapter 14. Read by J.C. Guan, Montreal, January 2009. Chapter 15 of 2 Years in the Forbidden City. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by J.C. Guan. 2 Years in the Forbidden City by Princess De Ling. Chapter 15. The Mid-Autumn Festival. On the 15th day of the 8th moon came the celebration of the Mid-Autumn Festival, sometimes called the Moon Festival. This name is derived from the belief which the Chinese hold that the moon is not permanently round when full, but that on this particular day it is a perfect circle. The ceremony which is gone through is conducted entirely by the court ladies, and consists of worshipping the moon as soon as it appears in the sky. In other respects, the celebrations are exactly the same as in the Dragon Boat Festival. Presents were exchanged between Her Majesty and the court officials. The festival concluded with a theatrical performance which describes a scene in the moon. The belief is that a beautiful maiden lives in the moon. her only companion being a white rabbit, called a jade rabbit. According to the play, this rabbit escapes from the moon to the earth and becomes a young and beautiful girl. A golden rooster, which lives in the sun, becoming aware of the rabbit's descent to the earth, himself descends from the sun and changes into a handsome prince. Of course, they very naturally meet and immediately fall in love. Now on the earth lived another rabbit, a red one, who, on finding out what was going on, changed himself into a prince also, and set about making love to the beautiful maiden, with the object of cutting out the rooster. However, he was seriously handicapped, inasmuch as he was unable to change the color of his face, which remained red. Therefore, his love-making met with no success, and the rooster prince had it all his own way. At this point, the beautiful maiden in the moon, on discovering her loss, sent the soldiers of heaven to recapture her rabbit, with the result that she was taken back to the moon, and the rooster being left alone, had no alternative but to reluctantly return to his home in the sun. During this performance, the head eunuch brought a young man into the courtyard, who kowtowed to Her Majesty. This was such an unusual occurrence that everybody noticed it. I could see that he was a stranger and did not belong to the court, and I wondered who he could be. At the other end of the veranda, I saw two or three of the court ladies whispering together and smiling. They finally came over to me and asked if I knew who he was. I told them that he was a stranger to me, and they ought to know better than I did, as they had been at the court much longer. Anyhow, I give it as my opinion that he was decidedly ugly. That same evening, Her Majesty asked me whether I had noticed this young man, and told me that he was the son of a very high Manchu official, that his father was dead, and that he had succeeded to the title and to a large amount of money. I was surprised that Her Majesty should give such a lengthy explanation about this young man, but I told her that I did not think him very handsome. Her Majesty was talking in a very serious manner, but I did not think anything of the occurrence at the time, but a few days later, while I was posing for the portrait, I heard Her Majesty whispering to my mother at the other end of the room. I saw that Her Majesty was holding a photograph in her hands, which she showed to my mother, at the same time asking whether my mother considered him good-looking. My mother answered, "Not very." On Her Majesty replying that beauty was not everything, I began to suspect that there was something going on which directly concerned me. I began to think of some excuse in order to get out of what I could plainly see was a proposed marriage between myself and this gentleman. I knew that if Her Majesty had made up her mind that I was to marry him, I could not help myself, but at the same time I made up my own mind that rather than marrying anyone whom I did not like, especially one I had never seen before, I would leave the court altogether. When Her Majesty retired for her usual afternoon rest, she told me she wanted to see me for a moment. After beating about the bush for some time, she asked me whether I would like to stay with her always, or whether I would like to go away again on some foreign country. I at once answered that I was quite satisfied to stay with her as long as she cared to have me, but that when she was tired of me, she could then send me away. Her Majesty informed me that it had been her intention to marry me to this young gentleman, and asked my opinion. I told her that I did not want to get married at all, especially seeing that my father was sick at this time, and leaving home to go to live apart from my family would break his heart and perhaps be the cause of his premature death. Her Majesty said that was no excuse, as I should not have to go out of China, but would be able to see my father and family any time I wished. I told Her Majesty that I would much rather stay with her altogether, and that I did not want to marry anybody. Her Majesty then said, "I won't listen to any excuse. I have already explained everything to your mother. But, much to my surprise, she said it would be better to mention it to you first, on account of your having been brought up differently from the rest of the court ladies. Had it not been this fact, I would simply have arranged everything with your mother, and the matter would have been settled so far as you were concerned. I could not say anything in answer to this, so I commenced to cry. I told Her Majesty that I was not like the rest of the court ladies, who pretended they did not want to marry, when all the time they were simply looking forward to getting married, if only for the change from the monotony of court life. I promised that I would stay with her forever, and that I had no desire to go away from China again. I explained that I should not have gone at all had it not been that my father was transferred to Paris. Her Majesty said, "Oh, well, I am very glad that you did go away, as you are more useful to me than you would have been had you stayed in China all your life." After a lot more discussion, Her Majesty said, "Well, I will leave you to think the matter over. If you don't like the young man I have chosen, there are plenty of others." Which remark did not help me very much, as I could see that she meant to marry me off anyway. However, I had managed to get out of it this time, and thought I would be able to arrange matters satisfactorily should the question come up again. Nothing further was said about the matter until nearly a month later, when I heard that a marriage had been arranged between this gentleman and the daughter of one of the princes. So everything ended very satisfactorily from my point of view. The 26th day of the 8th moon was the occasion of another celebration. At the time the Manchu dynasty began, Emperor Shunzi, who had fought very hard to gain the throne, found himself on the 26th day of the 8th moon absolutely out of provisions of every kind, and it was necessary for him and his army to live on the leaves of trees, which was the only form of food obtainable at the time. Thus, the anniversary of this day, even up to the present time, is always celebrated by the Manchu people, who deny themselves all luxuries, especially at the court. We did not eat any meat on that day, but only rice wrapped in lettuce leaves. Chopsticks were also discarded, and the food was conveyed to the mouth by the hand alone. Even the Empress Dowager was no exception to this rule. This is done in order to remind the present generation of the privation suffered by their ancestors who established the Manchu dynasty. Towards the close of the 8th moon, Her Majesty's gourd plants, which had been planted early in the spring, were ripening, and each day she would take us all to see what progress they were making. She would pick out those which she considered to be the most perfect in form, i.e., those with the smallest waist and tie ribbons around them, so as not to lose sight of them. She pointed to one of these plants one day, and said to me, "This reminds me of yourself when dressed in foreign clothes. Surely you feel more comfortable in the clothes you are now wearing." When these gourds were quite ripe, they were cut down, and Her Majesty would scrape the outer skin with a bamboo knife, afterwards wiping the fruit with a wet cloth. They were then allowed to dry, and after a few days they would assume a brownish color, when they were ready for hanging as ornaments in the summer palace. In one room alone there were over 10,000 of these gourds of different shapes. It was the duty of the court ladies to periodically wipe these gourds with a cloth, in order to give them a shiny appearance, and also to scrape any new ones which were pulled and prepare them for the palace. None of us cared very much about this work excepting Her Majesty. One day, whilst attending to these gourds, I happened to knock the top off one of the old ones, which was Her Majesty's particular favorite. I dared not go and tell Her Majesty what had happened, and one of the court ladies suggested throwing the thing away altogether, and saying nothing about it, as Her Majesty would not be likely to find it out, having so many of them. However, I finally decided to go, and tell Her Majesty about it, and take punishment if necessary. For a wonder, Her Majesty did not make much bother about it. She said, "Well, it was quite an old one, in any case, and the top was all ready to drop off at any minute. So it happens that you were the one to wipe it, and of course it came off. It can't be helped." I told Her Majesty that I was very much ashamed at being so careless, especially as I knew it was one of her favorites, and there the matter ended. All the rest of the court ladies were in the waiting room, and were anxious to know how I would get out of it, and when I told them, they said that had it been any of them, there would have been a fine row. They laughed and said it must be nice to be a favorite, which made me feel very uncomfortable. I told the young empress exactly what had happened, and she said I was quite right to tell Her Majesty the truth, and told me to be very careful, as there was much jealousy going on. At the beginning of the ninth moon, the chrysanthemums commenced to bud, and it was the duty of the ladies of the court to go and trim them each day by cutting away all the buds, except one on each stalk. This trimming gives the flower a better chance of developing, a much larger blossom being the result. Even Her Majesty would help with this work. She was very particular about these plants, and would not allow any of us to meddle with them if our hands were not perfectly cool, as to touch them with hot hands would cause the leaves to shrivel up. These flowers are generally in full blossom about the end of the ninth moon or beginning of the tenth moon. Her Majesty had a wonderful gift of being able to tell what kind of flower would bloom from each separate plant, even before the buds appeared. She would say, "This is going to be a red flower." And we would place a bamboo stick in the flower pot with the name written on it. Then another, Her Majesty would declare to be a white one, and we would place a similar bamboo stick in the flower pot with the description, and so on. Her Majesty said, "This is your first year at the palace, and no doubt you are surprised at what you have just seen and heard me say, but I have never yet made a mistake, for you will see when the flowers commence to bloom." It was a fact, as everything turned out exactly as she had predicted. None of us ever knew how she was able to distinguish one from the other, but she was always right. I did once ask her to explain how she was able to tell, but she answered that it was a secret. All this time, the portrait was proceeding very slowly, and one day Her Majesty asked me how long I thought it would be before it was finished, and what the custom in Europe was as regards remuneration for such a portrait. I replied that it was customary to pay very handsomely, but she would not hear of such a suggestion, saying that in China it was not the custom, and that it would be regarded as an insult to offer money for such a service. She suggested decorating Miss Carl as a reward for her services, which she considered would be appreciated far more than a money present. There was nothing more for me to say at this time, but I determined to mention the matter again when a favorable opportunity occurred. During the ninth moon, a Russian circus visited Beijing, and of course everybody talked of little else. Her Majesty, hearing so much talk about this circus, asked what it was like, and after we had explained to her, she became very interested, and said that she would like to see it. My mother thought it would be a good idea to have the circus brought up to the Summer Palace, where they could perform, so she asked Her Majesty whether this might be done. Her Majesty was delighted with the idea, and arrangements were accordingly made for the performance. While everything was being fixed, the people belonging to the circus and the animals were quartered near our own house, and we had to feed them at our own expense. However, we wanted to show Her Majesty what a circus was like, so the expense did not matter. It took them 2 days to erect the tent and make all necessary preparations, and during this time Her Majesty received reports as to what was being done, and the progress they were making. The day before the performance, we noticed that Her Majesty, on coming from her audience, looked very angry, and on our inquiring what was the matter, she informed my mother and myself that some censors had raised objections against having this circus in the palace grounds, as there had never been anything of this kind allowed before, and they had begged Her Majesty to give up the idea. Her Majesty was very angry, and said, "You see how much power I have here. I cannot even have a circus without somebody raising objections. I think we had better pay them something, and let them go away." Of course, we agreed to anything she thought best. After considering for a time, Her Majesty jumped up and said, "They have the tent up already. They will talk just the same whether we have the circus or not. I will have it anyway." So the performance duly took place, and Her Majesty and all the court were delighted. One item consisted of a young girl walking and dancing on a large globe. This especially pleased Her Majesty, and she insisted on the performance being repeated several times. Another item of interest was the trapeze act. Of course, nobody present, with the exception of my mother, sister, and myself, had ever seen a circus performance before, and Her Majesty was very much afraid that the man would fall from the trapeze and kill himself. Another thing which interested Her Majesty was the bareback riding, which she thought simply wonderful. The only objection to the whole show which she raised was when it was suggested to bring in the lions and tigers, etc. She said it was not safe to bring wild beasts into the palace, and that she would rather not see this part of the performance. The proprietor of the circus, however, brought in a small baby elephant, which performed several clever tricks. This delighted Her Majesty more than anything else, and when the proprietor saw how pleased she was, he offered the elephants as a present, which she accepted. However, after the performance was over, we tried to make him go through his tricks again, but he would not budge an inch. So we had to give it up as a bad job, and send him away to be placed along the other elephants belonging to the palace. Altogether, there were 3 performances given by the circus, and before the final performance, the circus manager told me that he would very much like to show the lions and tigers. There was no chance of any accident, and it really would be worth seeing. So after a lot of discussion, Her Majesty finally consented to allow them to be brought in, but on the distinct understanding that they should not be let out of their cages. When they were brought in the ring, all the eunuchs gathered around Her Majesty, and after remaining in the ring for a few minutes, Her Majesty ordered them to be taken away again. She said, "I am not afraid for myself, but they might get loose and hurt some of the people." This item finished the whole of the performance, and the circus departed richer by some taels 10,000, which Her Majesty had ordered to be given to them. For the next couple of days, we discussed the merits of the circus, but afterwards Her Majesty, when referring to the subject, expressed great disappointment with the whole thing. She said she had expected something entirely different and far more wonderful. This was another characteristic of Her Majesty. Nothing pleased her for more than 5 minutes at a time. She said to me, "I don't see anything at all wonderful in foreign accomplishments. Take, for instance, this portrait which this lady is painting. I don't think it is going to be at all a good picture. It seems so rough." Her Majesty did not understand oil painting. Then again, why should she always want to have the things before her while painting them? An ordinary Chinese artist could paint my dress, shoes, etc., after seeing the things once. She cannot be very much of an artist, in my opinion, though you need not tell her that I said so. Continuing, Her Majesty said, "By the way, what do you talk about when you are posing for this portrait of mine? Although I don't understand what she is saying, still I can see she has a lot to say. Be sure not to tell her anything connected with the court life, and do not teach her any Chinese. I hear that she often asks what different things are called in Chinese. But don't tell her. The less she knows, the better for us. I can see that she has seen nothing of our ordinary court life, as yet. I wonder what she would say if she were to see one of the eunuchs being punished, or anything like that. She would think that we were savages, I suppose. I noticed the other day, when I was angry, that you took this lady artist away. This was very wise of you. It is better that she should not see me in a temper. She might talk about it afterwards. I wish this portrait was finished. The cold weather is coming on, and we have to open up the boxes and get our winter clothes ready. You girls need winter clothes, I know, as you have none but foreign dresses. Then again, my birthday is next month, and there will be the usual celebrations. After that, we return to the Sea Palace. And what can we do with this artist? I suppose she will have to go back and stay at the American Legation, and come to the Sea Palace each day until the work is finished. This will be a lot of trouble, as it is not 10 minutes' drive as at present, but nearer an hour's drive. And even if this can be satisfactorily arranged, what about the Winter Palace in the Forbidden City? Try and get to know how long she expects to be before it is finished. This gave me an opportunity to tell Her Majesty that Miss Carl was just as anxious to get the work finished as she was to have it finished, but explained that Miss Carl had very little time to paint as Her Majesty could spare very little time to give personal sittings, and again, when Her Majesty went to lie down each afternoon, Miss Carl had to stop painting as she was working in the next room to Her Majesty's bedroom. Her Majesty replied, "Well, if she expects me to sit for her all day long, I will give up the whole thing at once." And then added, "I think you yourself are getting tired of sitting, and want me to take it up again, but I have already had quite enough of it." Of course, I told her that instead of being tired of it, I enjoyed sitting on her throne, which I regarded as a great honor. I explained to Her Majesty that Miss Carl did not like me to pose in her place, as she could not get along so quickly as if she were to sit herself, but she simply said that I was acting under her commands, and that should be sufficient for me. For the next 10 days we were kept very busy, selecting materials for winter clothing, and also official robes for my sister and myself to be worn during the forthcoming birthday celebrations. These dresses were full winter court dresses of red satin, embroidered with golden dragons and blue clouds, and were trimmed with gold braids and lined with grey squirrel. The cuffs and collars, which were turned down, were of sable. While Her Majesty was giving one of the eunuchs instructions as to how these were to be made, the young empress beckoned to me, and I went out. She said, "You go and kowtow to Her Majesty, as it is a great favor for her to give you a dress trimmed with sable. This is usually worn by a princess." So when I returned to the room, I availed myself of the first opportunity to kowtow and thank Her Majesty for the great favor she had granted me. She answered, "You deserve it, and I see no reason why you should not be treated as a princess anyway. Many of the princesses are not of the imperial family. Any title may be bestowed for special services rendered to the country, and you have been of more help to me than any other court lady I have ever had, and I can see that you are faithful in the discharge of your duties. You may think I do not notice these things, but I do. You are certainly entitled to be ranked as a princess, and in fact I never treat you differently from the princesses, but rather better in many ways." Turning to a eunuch, she said, "Bring me my fur cap here." This cap was made of sable, trimmed with pearls and jade, and Her Majesty explained that our caps would be something after the same style, except that the crown, instead of being yellow, as in the case of Her Majesty's cap, would be red. I was naturally delighted. In addition to the cap and full court dress, Her Majesty had 2 ordinary dresses made for everyday wear, one lined with sheepskin and the other lined with grey squirrel. Then she gave us 4 other dresses of finer material, lined with black and white fox skin, and all trimmed with gold braid and embroidered ribbons. In addition, there were two other dresses, one of a pale pink color embroidered with 100 butterflies, and the other of a reddish color embroidered with green bamboo leaves. Several short jackets, also lined with fur, were also included in Her Majesty's present, and several sleeveless jackets went to complete the lot. On coming out of the room, one of the court ladies remarked that I was very lucky to receive so many clothes from Her Majesty, and said that she had never received so many during the whole time she had been at the palace, nearly 10 years. I could see she was jealous. The young empress, overhearing this conversation, joined us and told her that when I arrived at the palace I had nothing but foreign clothes, and how was I to manage if Her Majesty did not get me the proper dresses? This incident was the beginning of another unpleasant time for me with the ladies of the court. At first I took no notice, until one day one of the girls attached to the palace joined in the unkind remarks. She said that before my arrival she had been Her Majesty's particular favorite, but I gave her to understand that she had no right to discuss me in any way whatsoever. The young empress, who was present, spoke to them about their treatment of me, and said that some fine day I would be telling Her Majesty about it. This seemed to have a good effect, for they never troubled me much afterward with their talk. End of chapter 15. Read by J. C. Guan, Montreal, January 2009.
Fall into big savings, all in the Kroger app. Get packs of juicy red, green, black, or tri-color variety seedless grapes for $3.99 each. Then get tender boneless chuck roast or steaks for $4.99 a pound, all with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.